Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, October 27, 2017. The UN says authorities in Yei River State are still blocking aid agencies from reaching internally displaced people.
Government of Yei River State respects and upholds the relevant provisions of international humanitarian law, human rights law, and the UN guiding principles of humanitarian emergency.
And Jonglei State officials say they are preparing to repulse an attack from Buma State.
Because I don't think whether there's anything that will be gained in attacking other communities, raiding their cattle and abducting their children. It is an ugly habit that has been condemned by all conventions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says security officials have once again denied aid agencies access to thousands of people who need humanitarian assistance in Lasu Payam, a rebel-controlled area in Yei River State's Otogo County. Residents say they lack basic necessities, including food and medicine. But Yei River State's governor says the government has not denied access to the vulnerable. Daniel Martin Friday has the story for VOA from Yei.
In its monthly humanitarian bulletin published today, UNOCHA says that on October 13th, security officials denied access to a group of aid agencies trying to provide emergency relief aid to thousands of people affected by the conflict in Lasu Payam. OCHA says even though aid agencies had already obtained permission from both warring parties to access the area, security officials still prevented a convoy of more than 20 vehicles to leave Yei. OCHA says humanitarian conditions are dire for thousands of people displaced by a conflict in Lasu Payam. Area resident Asunta Kiden says the main road connecting South Sudan to the Democratic Republic of Congo still remains closed. Speaking in Arabic, Kiden says her children and many villagers have no access to food or medicine. She is asking the warring parties to lay down their weapons and allow people to move freely.
We don't have roads. We started our journey at 1 a.m. and we walked through the bushes up to morning to the Yei town to find out medicine for my child. Our children are malnourished in the village. There is no good feeding.
Another resident who prefers to be identified only as Taban for safety reasons agrees that access to medicine and food remains a huge challenge to villagers in Lasu Payam. He is asking the United Nations and other aid agencies to move quickly to help most vulnerable in the area.
I came from the village because I am very sick. We are suffering from different kinds of diseases, and secondly, we don't have good food. We want the UN to reach the villages and see themselves the suffering of the people.
While Godwill, spokesman for the SPLA-IO military-appointed governor, accuses the government of repeatedly denying aid agencies access to areas under rebel control.
For several occasions, we have been condemning the government against blocking humanitarian agents from entering our corridors. SPLM-IO, government of Yei River State, respects and upholds the relevant provisions of international humanitarian law, human rights law, and the UN guiding principles of humanitarian emergency relief. As part of this compliance, we do provide clearance for access to humanitarian agencies so to deliver assistance to the people who are in dire need of that.
Yei River State Governor David Lokonga Moses says state authorities are committed to restoring peace so that aid agencies can deliver humanitarian assistance to the rural population. Lokonga says both national and state government officials have granted permission to all humanitarian agencies to access any of the state's 13 counties.
All the NGOs in the side of the government agreed that there is accessibility. The government had nothing to say obstructing anybody going to where they wanted to go. Here, UNMISS are here, and the UNOCHA are here. With all the agencies, we have given all the necessary permission for them to travel where they want to go. So I think I wanted to appeal that let us give chance to humanitarian agencies to travel to areas where they can be able to access and give support to our people.
Tens of thousands of people have left their homes in Yei River State and have sought refuge in neighboring Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thousands of others remained internally displaced as a result of deadly violence that spread to the area in July of last year. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin.
Jonglei State authorities are accusing youth from Buma State for preparing to attack areas of Jonglei. An official from Jonglei State believes an attack is imminent, but says residents will defend their area. Buma authorities deny youth are mobilizing to attack communities in Jonglei State. Deng Gai Deng has this report for VOA from Bor.
Jonglei State Deputy Governor Agot Alier says state authorities were tipped off about plans by Buma youth to attack areas of Jonglei State.
There are already mounting informations and concern about the youth mobilization in Pibor area, and especially in the areas of Gomorok, Manyabol, Lilkwangle, and other areas. Another complication in this scenario, and that is the mobilization itself, is the presence of the rebel elements of Mr. Khalid Boutros in Buma area. The intention of this youth mobilization is to carry out a cross-border attacks to other neighboring communities, mostly in Jonglei State and in Bia State.
Earlier this year, thousands of youth from Jonglei State attacked parts of Buma State in what they said was an attempt to rescue thousands of cattle stolen and children abducted by Buma youth. The violence left thousands of Buma residents displaced from their homes. Following the violence, President Salva Kiir appointed a committee led by First Vice President Tavan Dengai to resolve the conflict. In May, the governors of both states signed an agreement to end hostilities between the youth of the two communities. Deputy Governor Alier is appealing to the First Vice President to intervene.
Because I don't think whether there is anything that will be gained in attacking other communities, and raiding their cattle and abducting their children. It is an ugly habit that has been condemned by all conventions, including the UN Convention, because it tantamount to human trafficking.
A UN general, a spokesperson of Dinka Bor Youth, says young people in the area are mobilizing to defend the area against attackers, and he blames Buma State youth for violating the agreement signed in May.
And we are on standby, moving ahead, looking for our cattle and our children, because these people are coming to attack us, and there is no response from the office of the First Vice President. We will never, never, never respect this peace, this ceasefire again, because the 45 violations happens from Murle youth.
Guy spokesman Chua Lam says the government in Juba is not aware of any youth mobilization underway and urges both Jonglei and Buma authorities to control their youth. He says Guy's office is arranging a peace conference in Pibor for November 23rd. Buma State Information Minister Kudumuch Nyakurono denies state authorities are mobilizing youth to attack parts of Jonglei.
If there is something like that, I don't think the government are involved in such a thing. It will be just something which is done by the criminal who are always raiding people's cows.
Nyakurono says should it turn out that it is happening, authorities will stop the mobilization campaign. Nyakurono is urging Jonglei, Buma and Bia State authorities to end criminal activities in the region and work together to restore peace and focus on developing the area. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng reporting from Bor.
President Salva Kiir is scheduled to travel to Khartoum next week to meet with Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir. Mr. Kiir's spokesman says the two leaders will discuss how to fully implement the 2012 cooperation agreement, which covers trade, citizenship, and border issues. As Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba, Mr. Kiir has asked Washington to mediate the talks.
Presidential spokesman Atenue Katang says President Kiir will meet with Sudan President Omar al-Bashir in Khartoum on Tuesday.
The reason for traveling to Khartoum is in response to the arrangement that was made earlier when the presidential advisor for security affairs, Honorable Tout Galwak, went to Khartoum to arrange for the meeting of the two presidents.
Ateng says President Kiir and his delegation will discuss with their Sudanese counterparts ways to implement the cooperation agreement signed in 2012, which includes security, oil, border and trade arrangements, among others.
The president will be traveling with a number of officials, including the business community would be also having a representative that will travel in the wake of the president traveling to Khartoum in order to negotiate with their counterpart in Sudan. Because we want to make the two countries, to have a working relationship.
Atang says, in the 5 years since the two leaders signed the cooperation agreement, implementation has stalled. He says the mini-summit between the two presidents is meant to add importance to the agreement so it can be fully implemented.
There are about 9 cooperation agreements that are going to be rejuvenated, and there will be a working document this time. And the two countries, given that this is a presidential summit that is going to take place, it will be adhered to this time.
Atang says the Kiir administration realizes that cooperation between Sudan and South Sudan is necessary for peace to prevail in the two countries.
Sudan and South Sudan relation is crucial, even for the American to see peace coming to two countries. It is crucial that Sudan and South Sudan has to have some sort of cooperation. And as the Americans are working tirelessly to make sure that South Sudan is stable, and also Sudan has to also, as a very important ally against terrorism.
During U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley's visit to Juba this week, President Kiir appealed to the U.S. to do more to make sure Sudan-South Sudan relations are cordial. Atang says Mr. Kiir asked the U.S. to help the two countries settle the status of the disputed Abyei area, which both countries claim as their territory.
The president hoped that, U.S. will work to ensure that, the relationship between the two countries is intact and continue to be as historical as it was.
It is not clear when President Kiir is expected to return to Juba. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what is happening in Kenya's rerun elections? Find out when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you send remittances to family members? If so, where?
Yes, I do send to my children in different countries. I send them USD, SSP, and they will convert it there.
No, I'm a student. I'm just being supported right now. I'm stranded. There's no fees, and I'm just here. So I don't send money. I have no source of money.
Yes, obviously, if I was also earning something good and I'm working somewhere else, I would want to do the same because it shows the appreciation and it shows that you have not forgotten the people back home.
My family is in Uganda, so that's where I remit the money to them. It's my obligation to take care of my family, and I'm here because of them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Kenya's Electoral Commission has called for patience and calm as it tallies the results of Thursday's rerun presidential elections. However, some already fear that the low turnout, just 35% compared to nearly 80% in the previous poll in August, may undercut the credibility of the results. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The chief of Kenya's Electoral Commission says 6.5 million voters, about one-third of all registered voters, cast ballots in the election Thursday. Opposition leader Raila Odinga told his supporters to boycott the vote, and some polling stations looked like ghost towns. Others had lines, but significantly shorter than the original August election. Some were closed entirely due to security concerns. Murithi Mutiga is the International Crisis Group's Kenya analyst.
If this turns out to be the final act in what has been a very dramatic election, it will be a very unsatisfactory conclusion for all sides. Certainly for the president, he will move forward with what seems like a very shaky mandate without a clear mandate from the people. That's a very, very low turnout. It's the lowest turnout in Kenya's multi-party history. We've had six elections since 1992, and the lowest was just about 57%. In general, Kenyan election turnout levels are always above 65%.
The Electoral Commission said voting would take place Saturday in four areas of western Kenya where polling was halted due to violent clashes between protesters and security forces. But late on Friday, the commission said electoral staff would be at risk and postpone the voting to an undetermined future date. As of mid-afternoon Friday, the IEBC reported that it had received the large majority of official polling station forms and official constituency forms back from the field, but had yet to announce any vote count. President Uhuru Kenyatta is making his second attempt at re-election. The Supreme Court nullified his victory in the August 8th poll, ruling that the Electoral Commission had not followed electoral law and the Constitution. Odinga called for several members of the commission to step down and for the polls to be postponed beyond a 60-day deadline announced by the court. The opposition has not said whether it plans to file a legal challenge against the results of Thursday's election. Odinga told supporters he would give further instructions on Monday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Still in Kenya, political and religious leaders in Western Kenya warned that plans to reattempt polling in four counties will further inflame tensions. The Electoral Commission postponed voting in those areas Thursday due to security concerns amid an opposition boycott. Late today, the Electoral Commission postponed the voting again, citing threats to electoral staff. No new dates has been announced. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Kisumu.
Western Kenya is a stronghold of opposition leader Raila Odinga. Residents say they plan to respect Odinga's call to boycott the polls. Resident Joshua Ochieng says, "I am not going to vote, and I will make sure no one goes to vote. Because every time we vote, our victory is stolen. This should be the last time our victory is stolen." Violent unrest prevented polling stations from opening in the city of Kisumu Thursday. Youths block roads and clash with security forces. Hospital officials tell VOA three people were killed by gunshot wounds and more than 50 were injured. There were more protests in some parts of Western Kenya Friday. Local media report that one person was shot dead in Bungoma County. Church leaders in Kisumu gave a press conference Friday, saying they feared more bloodshed if election officials tried to proceed with polling. Bishop David Kodai of the Anglican Church of Kenya Bondo Diocese.
We want to say categorically as church leaders, we don't condone violence and will never condone it in any other way. But every individual, every single human being has a right to self-defense. And a time may come when our people will have to defend themselves in whichever way possible.
Kisumu County Governor Anyang Nyong'o said people cannot be forced to take part in the election.
The assumption is really made that if these people have said that they are not going to vote, then the next step that the government should take is bring force here to force them to vote or to force them not to prevent others not to vote. Now, that's a tall order. I'd rather you persuade them not to do that than create maximum force to force them. You just alienate people further.
Kisumu was mostly quiet Friday, with many streets clear to traffic and some shops open for business. But late in the day, VOA saw youth burning tires and blocking some roads in the city. They told VOA they were trying to block the delivery of ballot papers. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Kisumu, Kenya.
From Kisumu, we move back to South Sudan. A South Sudanese model will take part in Victoria's Secret's fashion show this year in the United States, which is expected to draw millions of television viewers around the world next month. The fashion show is sponsored by Victoria's Secrets, a brand of lingerie and sleepwear. Shir Deng has the story for VOA from London.
Meet Grace Ball. She's a South Sudanese supermodel that has taken the fashion industry by storm. You may have seen her in ad campaigns for big designer names like Burberry or Marc Jacobs, or on the runways of Paris, New York, London and Milan. But it's on Victoria's Secret stage where she'll make history late next month, when she becomes the second South Sudanese model after Lek Wek to walk the highly coveted Victoria's Secret's fashion show.
Victoria's Secret is one of my biggest accomplishments, but I had had others, big industry designers, and I'm excited about it. I'm just going to see what I'm going to do on stage, and I...
Long before the glamour, the 5'10" beauty's journey began in Sudan, where civil war ravaged the country in the late 1980s and early 90s. Ball and her family were forced to flee this Kakuma refugee camp. Throughout her journey, Ball remembers lessons her grandmother taught her that have helped her thrive in the fashion industry.
I grew up with her half of my life, and every time I look at her and I know what she have went through, and she still have a smile in her face, she still going with her day, that part amazed me about her.
Ball tries to replicate her grandmother's strength and grace on the runway, but she also praises African models who changed the industry decades ago for black models. Ball, who has been compared to supermodel Grace Jones, says she's heavily inspired by Lek Wek, the first South Sudanese supermodel who inspired Ball to wear short hair. Ball hid her career from her family when she first started 7 years ago, out of fear that they would not embrace it. The model says her family wanted her to concentrate on academia. That fear has been replaced by a determination to succeed in fashion, while at the same time encouraging young women to work hard, no matter how difficult it gets.
I start from scratch, and every year I'm surprised of how far I have gone. Burberry was my second year here in London doing the show I did it last season. Listen, second season actually. I didn't know I was going to walk for Burberry, but somehow it happened, and I can't be thankful enough for it.
On some of London's most prominent streets are posters of Ball's high fashion campaigns, featuring her flawless deep brown skin and short close-cropped black hair. But Ball says the ongoing conflict in her home country is always in her thoughts. It was only in 2009 that Ball was reunited again with her grandmother during her first return trip to her hometown of Warap after 15 years. Ball says she was happy to be home again and be with her grandmother, who had no idea if she was dead or alive.
But it took myself to go there to see for my own, and I felt better because it's not as bad as people write about it. There is a bad, but I just wish people will say the changes, the good changes that had happened, you know, from since I was a child, or my parents when they were going through it. It was worse than today.
Ball's parents moved from Sudan to Uganda to Kenya. Then in 1998, they relocated to America. Ball never pictured her journey from her war-torn village in Warab would land her in the American and European fashion industry. As for other inspiring young South Sudanese models, Ball advises them to take care of their bodies, to moisturize daily, to be proud of their features.
My advice to them is just be yourself. If you really love this, I think you should try to do something that will benefit you in life beside it and have fun with it.
So far it's worked for Ball, who says she'll continue to work hard to inspire the next generation of South Sudanese. For VOA, I'm Cher Deng in London.
Another South Sudanese model had some tough time accepting her dark skin. Nyakim Gatwich tells Ayen Bior that even though she has overcome being bullied and survived the temptation of bleaching her skin, she continues to struggle in the modeling industry, where she says fair skin is still preferred over dark skin.
The modeling industry, I honestly, the first thing I would say for sure is that I could see it change, you know, it's changing. But I also feel like it's very biased. It's biased toward fair skin. I mean, it's just like the modeling industry is more like I feel like a light-skinned girl is more likely to get a job than me, you know?
So despite all the praise that you've gotten for being dark-skinned and embracing your dark skin, there's still hurdles that you face in the modeling industry because of it.
Yes, there still is, definitely. Even though on social media, they they praising it and talking about how beautiful it is behind closed door when I actually go to cast or when I actually go to event. It's still like I'm not getting, you know, I'm not getting all the job, or I'm not getting, you know. It's just like, oh, we already have your look. I'm like, what is that supposed to mean? What if we already have your look? Like, not all black people look alike. You know, there's so many white models. There's so many light-skinned models. Not all the dark skin. They have like 4, 5, 6, 7 dark-skinned models in the industry, and then they say, we already have your look, you know?
How did your parents react when they found out that you wanted to pursue modeling? I mean, as you know, a career in modeling does not fit the doctor, lawyer, engineer narrative that most South Sudanese parents encourage us to pursue.
It really didn't. But my mother at first was really skeptical because when she thinks of model, she just thinks about being in bikini and you being naked, you know? Or I didn't bring you to America so you could come and walk naked in front of people, you know? So at first, she really didn't like it. So when I was in high school, when I was talking about it and saying, Mom, this is what I want to do, she's like, no. But then she realized that I was very passionate about it and I'm not going to give up. And then she just gave in, you know?
What advice do you have for young South Sudanese women who want to follow in your footsteps?
It's not going to be easy. And first, I say that first thing you have to do is love yourself. You know, just know that you know your worth. Sudanese, South Sudanese is the most beautiful people. I believe they, you know, they, our skin, this is a gift. It's not a curse, you know. Accept it, love it, embrace it so that you just shine. It shines through you that, you know, this is something you accept, that nobody could, anything that anybody could say will not affect you. So if you love yourself and you have confidence in yourself, I feel like you can do anything.
That's South Sudanese model Nyakim Gatwech speaking to Ian Beer from the U.S. Midwestern city of Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's our show for this Friday, when I'll leave you with the song Omega by Victoria Ole. We've been listening to Victoria Ole performing her song Omega. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Would like to know what you think about our show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also check us out on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. You have a peaceful weekend and join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mama, tabu mala shidi.